Good Wednesday evening. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday night, July 22nd, 2020. Ahead tonight, going virtual as social distancing continues. United Way of Northwest Arkansas is making this year's Fill the Bus Drive an all-digital experience. And the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum is starting a new lecture series, online and live. We'll learn more details about both ahead. On tomorrow's Morning Edition, on a tree-lined avenue in Richmond, Virginia, black teens make music under a statue of Robert E. Lee. A space where black Americans once felt unwelcome is changing. Monument Avenue, then and now, on Morning Edition from 5 to 9, tomorrow morning on 91.3. Arkansas is reporting fewer new cases of COVID-19 than the previous several days, but there are also fewer test results received as well. Governor Asa Hutchinson conducted today's press briefing at Washington Regional Medical Center in Fayetteville and reported the state's new cases in the most recent 24-hour monitoring period, 591, but with just fewer than 4,000 test results received during that same period. The governor says the new case total should carry an asterisk because of those low testing numbers. The state is reporting 6 additional deaths from the virus. There are fewer Arkansans hospitalized because of COVID-19, down by 14 from the previous day, that after reaching the highest total of the pandemic on Tuesday. There are 474 people in Arkansas hospitals because of the virus. Before today's briefing, the governor says he met with Northwest Arkansas healthcare professionals.
I just want everybody to know that I could see a lot of exhaustion and stress on their face. And it just, the stress of dealing with very seriously ill patients, watching some of them pass away in very lonely circumstances, it takes a toll on you emotionally. And I just wanted to thank them for what they're doing to save lives and the difference they're making.
Dr. Jose Romero, Arkansas's acting Secretary of Health, says the overall positivity rate in Washington County since testing began is 22%. And the county's cases have a different makeup from national trends.
Most of our cases, that is 72% of our cases, are in individuals that are 44 years and under, which actually points to the fact that these are individuals that are engaged in work and are acquiring the disease in the community or possibly spreading it at their work sites. Interestingly, and we've noticed this in a number of counties here in Arkansas, we have a higher rate of children that are infected. And in our county here, we have 17.9% of the cases in children. The national trend is about 2 to 3%. And again, this represents most likely spread within tight-knit family units.
During the most recent testing period, 46 new cases were reported in Benton County, 38 in Washington County. Pulaski County in central Arkansas had the most new cases, 80. In all, 8 Arkansas counties reported at least 20 new cases. And Dr. Romero says the fatality numbers for the state announced each day by the Department of Health do lag behind the actual numbers of deaths because there isn't yet a seamless way, considering HIPAA laws, of transmitting all the information quickly from counties to the Arkansas Department of Health. Also at today's briefing, a pair of hospital administrators, Dr. Larry Shackelford, the president and CEO of Washington Regional, and Eric Penalto, president of Mercy Hospital Northwest Arkansas, discussed the peaks of cases the regional hospitals experienced earlier this summer, numbers they say that have decreased since then. Penalto says the Northwest Arkansas peak so far was about 2 weeks ago.
We saw the early stages of the COVID surge here in Northwest Arkansas beginning in mid-May. It increased pretty much until about 2 weeks ago, where we peaked at 45 COVID patients in our hospital. Since that time, we've seen the numbers come back down to the mid-20s, and we're very excited about that. I think we saw a peak in Northwest Arkansas of 120 hospitalizations among all the hospitals, and that number's come down quite a bit, as the governor's numbers showed.
Penalto says the collaboration between hospitals in the two counties has been an essential tool to helping healthcare workers in the region and has allowed Northwest Arkansas patients to stay in the region during their hospitalizations. Governor Hutchinson says the fewer cases in Northwest Arkansas represent a beginning of a success story in the region, but one that isn't yet completed. And the governor says testing in Washington County isn't yet at a rate that's needed. And he says delays in results for some people can be problematic. He says some results in the state come in a couple of days. Others can take 7 to 10 days.
It's a problem in our contact tracing. It's a problem in how much time they're off work. What do they do when they're waiting for those results? They quarantine. All kinds of issues whenever you do not have timely results. And that was very fair of you because a lot of people I talk to are getting it within 1 to 2 days, 2 days, 3 days. Then you have others that have a longer period of time. The same experiences in the hospital environment. Some of it depends upon who the commercial lab provider is, who you're going to. Sometimes you have to switch because one's taking too long, another one has less of a backlog. So we have to adjust as a state, trying to find the best sources for that from our standpoint. And of course, those are individual clinicians' decisions too as to who they send the lab tests to. It is a problem. We're pushing every lever we can to change the ingredients there and to get a better result.
Today's briefing clocked in at 51 minutes, one of the longest the governor has hosted since the beginning of the pandemic. It included comments about the upcoming school year, the 2020 census, economic recovery in the state, and more. The briefings are archived at the governor's YouTube channel, and you can also follow developments at the COVID-19 update page at KUAF.com and through our morning newscast each Monday through Friday at 5:30 and 7:30. With Antoinette Grajeda. 91.3 KUAF also carries the briefings, which begin almost every day at 1:30. Both Rogers and Bentonville school districts are requiring students and employees to wear masks when the school year begins next month. The Rogers measure was passed unanimously last night by the school board. The Bentonville measure passed last night 6-1. Earlier, school boards in Springdale, Fort Smith, and Bentonville had passed similar requirements. This is Ozarks at Large. Graduate assistants at the University of Arkansas are asking for higher wages. The request comes as the pandemic has made it more difficult to obtain a second job or meant more time preparing to teach in socially distanced classrooms or even remotely. After sending a letter with the request to the chancellor at the beginning of this month, the university has issued a formal response. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Allie Hintz is a graduate teaching assistant in the English department working on her Master of Fine Arts degree in creative writing. Hintz says students have been discussing taking action on their wages, but what prompted them to coalesce and write the letter was the Black at UARC hashtag. Last month, students started using the hashtag on social media to share their experiences as Black students at the University of Arkansas.
And it got us talking more about how little diversity there is in both the undergraduate student body and the graduate student body, and ways that we could, you know, help increase that diversity. And one thing that we just kept coming up with is, you know, this stipend isn't really enough to attract many students, especially students who don't have family support or whatnot.
82 graduate students signed a letter sent to Chancellor Joseph Steinmetz July 1st. The letter asks the university to set up a special fund to pay an emergency $2,500 stipend during the 2020-2021 academic year to all graduate assistants making less than $15,000 to help students in crisis as a result of lost work during the pandemic. Hintz has a 9-month appointment, which she says is designed to give students 3 months to have a summer job. However, the pandemic is complicating that, and Hintz, for example, didn't get a job at a restaurant this summer like she planned.
I'm from a middle-class family. I, you know, have some savings, so I'm not food insecure, but I'm eating beans and rice a lot of days, you know? Yeah, we don't get any salary over the summer. So we only get salary on those 9 months. So I'm looking forward to that first payment in August.
According to a 2016 report from the Center for Community Engagement, which oversees the university's food pantry, 47% of graduate students have low to very low food security. Markeith Woods is a graduate assistant working on his MFA in painting, who says he works multiple jobs to support his family.
That's kind of like my, you know, situation, trying to be a husband and also a father and living off of only $15,000, which for me has made me, you know, take on other side jobs. I'm currently working at Lowe's right now, part-time. And I've did other, like, art events to kind of, you know, make up the difference.
The letter sent to the chancellor requests a plan be in place by the 2021-2022 academic year to increase the minimum stipend to $20,000. The letter argues other state schools often pay higher wages. For example, the minimum stipend for a 9-month appointment at the University of Missouri is $16,389 for a master's student and $18,026 for a doctoral student. That's according to the university's graduate school website. The letter also requests a waiver of student fees, 80% coverage of health insurance premiums, and coverage of dental insurance. While tuition is waived for GAs, they do pay student fees, which cost more than $1,000 annually. The university currently pays 66.6% of coverage of health insurance premiums, and dental insurance is available for purchase. On July 13th, the university sent an email to the campus community announcing the U of A had made progress on two initiatives. The first was all full-time staff who earn less than $30,000 will receive some increase this fall pending state approval. The second initiative is to increase the minimum graduate assistant stipend to $15,000 a year. The email links to a press release in which Chancellor Steinmetz says although graduate assistant stipends have been steadily increasing, officials recognize stipends are below that of peers in select areas. According to the press release, the situation has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. To address it, over the next few months, the campus will undertake a study to determine where to make strategic investments to raise graduate assistant stipends to a more competitive level. According to officials, the long-term goal is to move to a minimum stipend of $1,250 per month or $15,000 for a 12-month position. On July 14th, the group of graduate students received a response to its July 1st letter from the chancellor's chief of staff. It includes the paragraph from the press release that states the university's plan is to undertake a study over the next few months.
I don't know if I can find a word strong enough for it. I mean, it's cruel. It's very cruel. And, you know, and like dehumanizing, I think.
That's Josh Luckenbach, a graduate teaching assistant earning an MFA in creative writing.
We were expecting it to be a long battle, but we weren't expecting to be blown off in such a blatant and cruel way as we were.
Luckenbach points out that the university's goal to raise stipends to $1,250 per month means a student with a 9-month appointment like him would make $11,250 annually. That's less than the $12,500 he's making currently. According to data polled by the university July 2nd, 1,208 GA positions are currently filled. Of those, 226, or about 19%, make less than $1,250 a month. 45 of those students have a 9-month appointment, while 181 have a 12-month appointment. Luckenbach says some university officials have 6-figure salaries and can't relate to his salary and the challenges he's facing trying to live and eat in the same community as them.
I think that's a big part of the challenge is that these, you know, faculty are on our side, but a lot of the deans, the dean of the college, the dean of the graduate school, and the chancellor, I don't know that they can possibly understand that.
MFA candidate Allie Hintz says another part of the problem may be officials think of graduate students as undergraduate students who have parental support.
But there are a lot of people in these programs who are in their 30s or 40s who have children. Josh's wife just had a child back in the fall, which is wonderful. But there's no way you're able to support, you know, a single person on this salary, let alone a whole family.
Following receipt of the university's response July 14th, the graduate students sent an email July 15th that says the response is, quote, wholly inadequate and did not address their concerns. The email reads in part, quote, long-term goals and future plans are not enough. We need definitive action and timelines now. We are struggling now, end quote. The letter again requests a meeting with the chancellor, as well as with Kim Needy, dean of the Graduate School and International Education.
I've been in my role for 6 years. I have a student advisory board. I have a faculty advisory board. And I can tell you, we are constantly studying our stipends. We're constantly thinking about what we can do to raise them. And, you know, under my watch and the provost and the chancellors, we have been raising the graduate student stipends. They have been raising. Are we raising them enough? No. Can we do more? Yes.
Needy says stipends vary between departments, but the university has been increasing the minimum amount. About 4 years ago, she says the university's minimum stipend was $1,000 a month. Today, the minimum is $1,043 a month for master students and $1,159 a month for MFA and doctoral students. When comparing stipends between universities, Needy says it's important to research what other benefits are being offered as part of the compensation package.
Because at some schools where the stipends are even a lot higher, the students have to pay for their tuition. They don't get the free tuition. So at the University of Arkansas, for a student, a graduate student who's taking about 24 credits per year, the in-state tuition alone for them is over $10,000 per year. And so that is another benefit that they're getting as a result of that.
Needy says graduate assistants are so important to the teaching and research mission at the university, and increasing stipends has been on officials' radar for a long time.
I'm glad the students brought this up. I'm proud of the chancellor for taking it seriously, and the students should know that their efforts have really kind of got some action going to study this in a more timely manner.
The chancellor has now asked for the formation of a committee to study the issue.
We will be forming a committee that's made up of representatives from different colleges, as well as representatives from the graduate school and some students. So we expect to have, for example, a student representation from the Graduate and Professional Student Congress and from the Black Graduate Student Association on this committee.
Needy says finding a solution to this issue can be complicated. For example, she says officials have discussed creating more 12-month appointments, but that could mean fewer graduate assistantships overall.
We can do that by converting 9-month appointments to 12-month appointments, but given a flat budget, what that means is that instead of having 4 9-month graduate assistant positions, we would have 3 12-month graduate assistant positions, because that would still be paying the tuition and the stipends over 36 months. But what that does is then that eliminates a graduate assistant position for a student. So then 3 students get more, 1 student doesn't get anything. So, you know, it's a bit of a trade-off.
Needy says faculty and administrators were once graduate students too, so they recognize what GAs are going through and how they're trying to juggle everything.
We are committed to looking at this. We are committed to studying this. You know, we're in a bit of a perfect storm in the sense with the COVID, with the shutdown, and with the budget cutbacks that we've had. So it is a difficult time. I'm not trying to make excuses, but I am just saying that we need a little bit of time to work this. We're not going to stop when we get to this point. There are students that are making below this amount now, this monthly amount. So it is going to help a subset of students to get to a higher level. So I know that the students are frustrated, but we are committed to work with it. We'll have student representation on our committee. We hear them.
As the committee takes shape and discussions get underway, graduate assistants want to keep sharing their story. For example, they've started a petition at change.org that has more than 1,700 signatures. MFA candidate Josh Luckenbach says he also sent the petition to a couple of the undergraduate classes he taught last semester.
A lot of undergrads are food insecure, too. But I think a lot of those people would be surprised to know that, hey, the people teaching your advanced composition class, your world lit class, your creative writing class, those people didn't eat today and they don't know when they're going to, you know? I think the parents who are paying or taking out loans, or the students who are taking out enormous loans to come to school here, would be surprised to know that.
Kim Needy, Dean of the Graduate School and International Education, says she hopes the new committee can have its first meeting in a couple of weeks. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
The Arkansas Department of Commerce is announcing its second Arkansas Rural Connect broadband grant. The grant, more than $1.9 million, is awarded to the City of Ozark in partnership with Pinnacle Telecom. The project will deploy fiber to homes in the City of Ozark. The Arkansas Department of Commerce received $19.3 million in CARES Act funds for the grants after an approval from the CARES Act Steering Committee in the Arkansas Legislature. Grant recipients must expend the COVID-19 federal funds by December 30th of this year. Additionally, $4.7 million available in state funds for projects that would extend beyond December 30th of this year. The goal of the program, to provide high-speed broadband to rural communities. And the Arkansas Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Commission is approving more than $7.4 million for water and wastewater projects serving close to 4,000 people in five different Arkansas communities. Included in the awards, the City of Jasper in Newton County receiving a $440,000 loan and a $1.3 million loan with principal forgiveness from the Arkansas Clean Water State Revolving Loan Fund for improvements to the wastewater treatment facility there. And Washington County Soil and Water Conservation District received a $15,450 loan from the Water Development Fund to repair a sinkhole in Kenyon Lake Dam.
On a tree-lined avenue in Richmond, Virginia, black teens make music under a statue of Robert E. Lee.
When I'm playing, I don't think about him, I think about my ancestors.
A space where black Americans once felt unwelcome is changing.
It's not just the monuments that help to reinforce this racial divide. It's everything that comes along for the ride.
Monument Avenue, then and now, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, tomorrow from 5 to 9 a.m. on 91.3 KUAF. And this is Ozarks at Large. A reminder that KUAF presents jazz around the clock on KUAF 3, a station you can find on your HD radio in your car or at home, as well as by asking your smart speaker to play KUAF 3. You can also find the station at KUAF.com. Raven Cook, the founder and president of Foundation's Black History Educational Programming, must work around the clock given all the things she does. We do know she's in her home studio again this week to record another edition of Reflections in Black for us.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America by Michael Eric Dyson is one of those books that can be read over and over, yet still find some connection to the present moment. I'd read the book before, but caught myself sitting with it once more after the murder of George Floyd. The first line of the book reads, "America is in trouble, and a lot of that trouble, perhaps most of it, has to do with race." Written in the structure of a church service, Michael Eric Dyson eloquently weaves pop culture with the cadence of an historic tradition of oratory from the Black church. Every section proceeds in the order of a church service: a call to worship, hymns of praise, invocation, etc. With the scripture reading chapter focus on Dr. King, Dyson pulls no punches in reminding audiences of the radical spirit of the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The sermon portion of the text begins with an in-depth consideration of whiteness. Dyson writes, "I must say to you, my friends, that teaching in your schools has shown me that being white means never having to say you're white. Whiteness, long ago, at least in America, shed its ethnic skin and struck a universal pose. Whiteness never had to announce its whiteness, never had to promote or celebrate its unique features. If whites are history, and history is white, then so are culture and society and law and government and politics. So are logic and thinking and reflection and truth and circumstances and the world and reality and morality and all that means anything at all. Yes, my friends, your hunger for history is still pretty segregated. Your knowledge of America often ends at the color line. you end up erasing the Black story as the American story, Black history as American history. Dyson continues in the following pages, writing, "One of the greatest privileges of whiteness is not to see color, not to see race, and not to pay a price for ignoring it, except, of course, when you're called on it. But even then, that price pales quite literally in comparison to the high price Black folk pay for being Black. We pay a price, too, not for even being able to derive recognition and financial reward for the styles that make the world want to be Black so bad. They don't mind looking like us as long as they never, ever have to be us." Unapologetically, he leans into the topic of police brutality, writing, "Beloved, surely you understand how vexed we are by our situation. Surely you understand how the legacy of terror stalks us at every turn, dogs are every step. Surely you understand that police brutality pounds our lives in unrelenting waves. Can you not see that too many cops kill us off like animals without a second thought?" The book, while moving with the words of Dyson, is guided by the words of the ancestors. Each section leads with a quote from Black American voices like Toni Morrison, Fannie Lou Hamer, Alice Walker, James Baldwin, and others. The benediction answers a question frequently asked of me by white people: what should I do? Dyson lays it out, makes it clear, and ends the text with the simple phrase, "We are America."
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. You can hear weekly segments on Ozarks at Large, and you can find past editions at KUAF.com. Just search Reflections in Black.
This is Ozarks at Large. Each year for the past 10 years, United Way of Northwest Arkansas has spent a weekend in front of area Walmart stores to fill the bus. It's been a campaign to literally have volunteers fill buses with donated school supplies for children in more than a dozen Northwest Arkansas school districts. This year, the campaign is happening, but virtually. Last week, we reached Rhonda Bramell, the Director of Corporate Engagement at United Way Northwest Arkansas, and Jackson Braswell, Communications Manager for the organization. Jackson says the 2020 Fill the Bus campaign carries on a tradition in a new way.
For so many years, it's been a volunteer-based event where we call on people from the community to help us in the Walmarts around Northwest Arkansas and Southwest Missouri, really help us fill the bus. So we're looking forward to a little bit of a different challenge this year.
Yes, in those previous years, Fill the Bus was a literal title. You filled the bus. You brought in the materials and you put them on the bus. Now, of course, 2020 is changing so much. It's a bit different this year. How?
Yeah, so this year we're going to an all virtual platform. Thanks to our partnership with Walmart, we're able to use their registry for good. And so what that means is that people in the community can go to our website, go to the Walmart registry for good, buy school supplies, and they ship directly to the United Way offices, where we will sort them like they are going into a literal bus and distribute them out to the school districts.
Rhonda, this helps, I think, more than a dozen school districts in Northwest Arkansas.
That's right. Last year, we helped 15 different school districts all over Northwest Arkansas and then up into McDonald County, Missouri.
And what are we looking for? What can people contribute to this Fill the Bus drive?
Well, we, of course, collect your traditional supplies, pens and notebooks and glue sticks and that sort of thing. But this year, as you can imagine, the list looks a little different in some situations. So we've added things like hand sanitizer and face masks and water bottles. You know, the schools now want the kids to bring their own water bottles and not use the water. And so we've kind of adjusted that list according to the needs that we see will happen. We've consulted with some of the school districts and asked, you know, what do we need to add? And things like headphones and earbuds and things that the kids may need to even use at home for their technology. So we've added that all to the registry list, and it's all there. And in addition to that, if you are not, you know, fond of shopping or that's not your thing, we can also accept gift cards through the registry. You can purchase a Walmart gift card, and then the school can go and use it for maybe what they don't receive or what they don't receive enough of. Through our website, you can also make a monetary donation. So we've got, you know, several options to make it really easy.
2020 has had a very different spring. We're having a very different summer. We're going to experience a very different fall. I imagine at no point was there any discussion that fill the bus wouldn't happen somehow. I'm wondering, what were the discussions like leading up to this is how we're going to do it in 2020?
Well, I've kept contact with Walmart for the long haul. We're fortunate that we have Scott Bayless. He's a VP at Walmart. He's one of our co-chairs for the event. And so luckily, Scott had the forethought way back in November. He was like, you know, let's see if we can add an online component to this program and give a second option for people to shop online. So we actually set this registry up way back in November, not even anticipating that we would be utilizing it, you know, completely virtually. So so we're thankful that we were ahead of the curve, if you will. But, you know, our plan all along was to plan that it was going to happen until we heard otherwise. So and that's really how it played out.
Jackson, you can make contributions right now and through early August, correct?
Yes, we are live with the virtual Fill the Bus. So we're actively reaching out to the community and trying to raise awareness about the online platform. And we're looking forward to seeing, you know, what type of participation we're going to get and how much supplies we get to sort back at the office.
With the flexibility of the program now, instead of collecting for 2 days, we're able to collect, you know, over a month's time period. So I'm hoping that this will actually play to our advantage and give people that flexibility that if they forgot over the 2 day period, that now we have way more time that they can do their online shopping. Yeah. And of course, we want to recognize all of the sponsors and the people who are continuing to support this great event. In addition to Walmart, we've got BIC as a major sponsor, and we've got Crayola, and we've got Coca-Cola. And a new sponsor this year is Burl Behavioral Health Center. And so we're thankful and glad to have everybody on board, and they're excited to be all a part of it.
Rhonda Bramall is the Director of Corporate Engagement at United Way Northwest Arkansas. Jackson Braswell is the Communications Manager for the organization. The school supply drive lasts through August 10th. You can find out more at unitedwaynwa.org/bus.
Support for KUAF comes from Westwood Gardens, featuring a variety of locally grown annual and perennial plants, including herbs, roses, trees, and shrubs, selected to perform well in Arkansas's summer heat. WestwoodGardens.com or Facebook for more. Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Here's something about 2020. There has not been a week where John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock, with our partner, Talk Business and Politics, have had to even remotely scramble for conversation topics. Even before a mask mandate, social unrest, and a pandemic, there was an impeachment, remember? This week, they cover masks and the latest Arkansas responses to the pandemic, but Roby began their discussion by asking John Brummett about the legacy left by the late Congressman and civil rights leader John Lewis, who died last week.
I think his legacy is that the civil rights movement was brave. The civil rights movement was important. The civil rights movement is not over. But the finest elements of the civil rights movement were bravery at the time and good-natured, good-hearted vigilance thereafter. That's what John Lewis means to me. If he had every right to hate everybody, his skull was broken open. He was beaten near death for fighting for equality,
yeah,
fighting for basic rights. And yet everybody tells you, and he was here a couple of years ago whenever we had the congressional
2018, yeah.
For an appearance at Philander Smith for the students and to assist in Clark Trucker's campaign. And just a delight, the kind of sweet, generous guy you would expect him to be. And and always positive about doing good and going forth and making things better. When this world hit him in the head several times and broke his head open, to me the point is, take your blows, fight for right, and keep fighting with the best temperament that you can fashion, and hope that things continue to incrementally get better.
Last week, Asa Hutchinson finally comes out with the mask policy that you didn't think he was capable of coming up with.
That's simply not true,
Robert. Well, I'll let you go into that.
Okay.
But he did manage to offend just about everyone.
Uh-huh.
The people that said he should have done it sooner are not happy that he didn't do it sooner. There's exemptions in there. And then those who did not want a mask mandate at all are apparently going to protest on the Capitol.
By going naked, I guess, because they don't believe the government can tell them they have to wear something. That they must all now emerge unclothed into the public square.
Put all of this in context for me. I don't need the nakedness thought
well,
in there.
That's a logical
where does
follow.
This mask mandate go? Is it going to fall off of the planet, or is it going to actually be implemented?
I regret so much that you misstated my position.
Please
expressed
correct
very
it then.
Well here, just in this chair a week ago. I said, we're not going to go out here and arrest everybody without a mask. We're not going to start giving mask tickets. Do you remember? I actually pointed out to the street.
I remember
when I said
you
that.
Saying specifically a week ago that you didn't think that ASA would implement a mask mandate. You had awakened on Sunday morning
right.
after having tweeted something on
that
Saturday
I was
and wanted
going
to take it back. Right. And then you came out and did it.
Roby, again, misrepresentation. Fake news. Fake news. I tweeted last Sunday week ago, I believe we're going to get a mask mandate tomorrow. I woke up Monday morning, and I'm going, I don't know if this happens to anybody else, you or something's bothered me. I just woke up, and there's something. I did something bad yesterday, and then I thought, and I sat there on the bed, and went, oh, yeah, I predicted he's not going to do that today. I did not say he wasn't going to do it forever. I was just 3 days off. I stand proudly with the position that I said all along Asa Hutchinson was pragmatic and capable of this kind of thing. And he did it.
See, you reminded me of the president's position on when he said the coronavirus was going to eventually disappear. In the Chris Wallace uh-huh. interview, he said, well, eventually
will.
I will be right.
Yeah.
Eventually, you are right.
I think 3 days is going, for me, it's going to be closer than Trump's going to be. But I'll put my timetable up against the president's. Look, this was so eminently predictable. The sheriff up in Marshall, the police chief, of course. I said here last week, the point is not to have masked police. The point is not that everybody going down the road is if you're driving down the road and you think, wait a minute, I didn't see that strap over his shoulder, go arrest him. We don't do that. We have a seatbelt law, but we don't arrest. We have the policy. We enforce it when there is an occasion to enforce it, such as a wreck and you didn't have it, or we caught you speeding and you didn't have it, and here's a ticket. But we, the purpose is to encourage responsible behavior for health safety purposes. That's all I ever thought it would do. That's all it will ever do. And yes, we got some of these yahoos out there who say they're never going to put on a mask. And we got the authorities among these yahoos are saying they're not going to enforce it. Of course. What we need is for the state police district commanders to go see these sheriffs and these police chiefs and say, look, we said you're not going to arrest anybody. Ticketing is your discretion. We're going to ask you not to flaunt your disregard for this. We're going to ask you not to flout the law or the executive order.
It's too late. They've already flouted it.
We're going to ask you to enforce this thing if we have major events. We don't want you arresting or ticketing the old boy for being out here on the sidewalk and not having a mask. But if you've got people gathering, and you got people getting together close in the diner, we expect you to do something, and we will do something. I think that's the policy. Meantime, you hope for some residual improvement in our behavior, because people are now living in an environment in which wearing a mask is gubernatorially directed and government directed. Not everybody's going to do it, but maybe some infections will stay within the mask rather than get out into the public, and you've done some good. That's all I ever hoped it would do.
John Brummett is a political writer with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. His columns can be found at ArkansasOnline.com. He spoke with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. And there is much more from their conversation, including thoughts about the president and the November election. That can be found at TalkBusiness.net.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA, a conversation among young activists about what good allyship looks like today in the fight against anti-blackness and police brutality.
Allyship shouldn't be performative. It shouldn't be for other people. Like, as long as we know that you are our ally and that you are supporting us, that's all we need.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Latino USA, Sunday afternoon at 3 on 91.3. The Fort Smith Regional Art Museum, affectionately known as FSRAM, is about to explore art history online. And that means art from centuries ago, from decades ago, and from right now, too. The Lecture Live series begins next week, July 30th, and will start with an hour-long examination of Michelangelo. The series will be led live by Samantha Rhodes, assistant curator at the museum. She says leading a conversation about great art to an online group isn't as satisfying, perhaps, as leading one for a live audience, but she says there are some advantages to the approach.
And what's great about that is because, you know, our first Lecture Live is over Michelangelo. Well, you can't just cover Michelangelo within an hour, right? He's a very significant artist with a very interesting and deep history as to why he became so popular, why he was so popular during his time. But the great thing about that is whoever I am speaking to, so the visitors, if you will, attendees, will be able to look up these paintings while they're with me. So they don't just have to go off of my pictures that they see, but they can actually look them up and they can go find certain details that I'm talking about. Whereas you don't necessarily have that in a live presentation where somebody can, you know, very much interact with not only the picture or painting you're talking about, but they can access something else that reminds them of this. And so I know that during my lecture, I'm going to be switching between Michelangelo and Raphael. Well, I haven't included just a ton of pictures of Raphael. And so it's good for them to be like, well, what is the difference between these two artists? And then kind of have them side by side. And you're right. And I mean, it's education at your fingertips. And we are aware that the internet and our virtual cyber presence gives us many learning opportunities that we have not had access to throughout history.
So a Renaissance master to start the series, do you know yet what will be following in the weeks to come?
Yes. So the plan is we're going to kind of switch it up, and it won't always be on Renaissance masters. Eventually we'll make it to, you know, French Impressionism or, you know, European Modernism. We'll eventually make it through. We might be able to go back into, let's look at antiquity. Let's look at some of the ancient artworks. I started with kind of where my strength was to get the program kind of going. And so we're always going to be delving into something different, some different artists in history, depending on what movement or where we're going. I know that I'm going to cover the Italian Renaissance masters first, and then might move on to the Northern Renaissance, and then might move on to, you know, here's the Baroque, here's the Rococo era, here's the Victorian era. So that's kind of the overall plan for historical artists. And then we're going to incorporate contemporary artists. So, you know, kind of what we would consider, you know, contemporary hotshots. And that could be older contemporary artists. We know that Andy Warhol is not considered a modern artist. He's considered contemporary, so we'll be looking at some of his work. We'll be looking at contemporary artists today that are working today and doing stuff. And then we're also going to substitute in local artists. and kind of pull what the local artists and regional artists around kind of say, you know, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, in this region, you know, what are people doing right around here? That kind of interact with a national scale, maybe an international scale, and interact with artists throughout history.
All right, so we know it'll be different for the patrons because they'll be at home and they'll have access to things. How will this be different for you not doing this in front of a live audience, but not a live audience that's in the same space as you?
Well, you know, I am more comfortable being in front. I've got some teaching experience, so I am more comfortable being in front of a class and kind of having them raise their hands and be like, well, you know, I've got a question here. And I like the personal interaction. So I think it will be challenging in that sense because it'll be like, well, you know, well, I feel like I'm pretty much just lecturing to myself. But I think the good thing about it is that I will be able to still visually notice that people are there and in attendance, and there are going to be, there's going to be time for questions and people. It's going to be very casual. I want people to feel free to ask a question. I don't mind being interrupted. It's fine. And, or just, you know, here's a comment here, or what, you know, what about this? And I want people, you know, that's how people learn. I learn by asking a lot of questions too. And so it's going to be different, I think, on a virtual platform, but, you know, considering teachers, that's what teachers had to do this school year. That's what our education department has already had to do for certain classes. So it might be a strange transition, but it will be, I think, a successful transition as well.
Samantha Rhodes is assistant curator for the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum. She spoke with us yesterday. The first lecture live event is July 30th, beginning at 7 that night. Samantha says registration for this first lecture is filling up fast. It is free, and you can find out more about the series by going to fsram.org.
For the Central Arkansas Library System, I'm Mark Chris with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. A 1966 ruling that overturned a 1928 Arkansas law banning the teaching of evolution in public schools led to a two-night debate on the theory's merits. Professor James Bales of Harding University had written an anti-evolution tract that included a challenge to scientists to debate him on the subject. A copy found its way to Nobel laureate Herman Muller at the University of Indiana, who accepted the challenge and assembled a team that included the then-unknown Carl Sagan. Some 1,600 people crowded into Little Rock City Auditorium on June 28th to hear Sagan and Notre Dame's Ernan McMullen debate Bale and Harding's Jack Wood Sears. The Arkansas Gazette wrote that, "It seemed to be more of a series of monologues by persons without enough common points of reference to hold a logical dispute." Only 700 people showed up for the second night session, and a third debate was canceled. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the teaching of evolution in 1968. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Southwest City, Missouri, and a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors tonight included Antoinette Grajeda and Raven Cook. Our show and tonight's edition of Reflections in Black, engineered and mastered by Timothy Dennis. Our conversations between John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette and Roby Brock with Talk Business and Politics, part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can find out more about our show, as well as find past shows, stories, and interviews at OzarksAtLarge.com. We will be back with you tomorrow. That's Thursday, right? Yes, tomorrow at noon for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks so much for listening.